Welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 12th of December 2007. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is great to be here once again with you for this most important of live broadcasts. French Connection has been using its recently purchased bandwidth and airspace to try and affect some different delivery here. We put a lot of effort into trying to get a new way of getting in touch with new people, and of course this is only the infancy. We're hoping that new folks can do some of the marketing for us by turning people on to the kind of information we have. One thing we've been receiving from people is that they appreciate the depth of analysis that we've been giving on this financial crisis. And if you think back all the way into mid-November, we began talking about these problems with the swaps and derivatives and what that meant and how it was going to play out. And we were very close to on the money with it. I have to admit one thing, that I was a little bit behind the curve here on thinking that we would probably see much more serious problems by January or February, but it seems to be coming even quicker than I had anticipated. You know, it's almost impossible to time things because we're not holding those levers of power, and the people who are pull them at their interest, not ours. And so we don't know when the next shoe is going to drop often because we're not in charge of making the decision. So guesstimating sometimes is not accurate. But the facts on the ground that we can analyze give us good insights into what we can expect. Now, we're going to talk again with Mohammed Rafik about some interesting points about the development of this problem. One of the things that we've been talking about is the subprime. And what we really know is it's really just a loan packages that were given out for second mortgages. And we know that car loans have gone bad. And this is not just an American phenomenon. What we see now is huge amounts of money being pumped into the European economy as well. And you'll even see that reflected in the exchange rate. We were up at around 150 for a while there. It's down to 146 again because the Europeans are also finding it necessary to inject huge amounts of liquidity into their system, often having to come from offshore. And we're going to talk about that as well. But to lead this off, we're going to discuss something about Mr. Alex Jones, and that's going to go in for the first few minutes here. And I'm going to bring up my guest right away here. His name is Mohammed Rafik. He is an important part of the French Connections research staff here, or team, if you will, because he's done so much reading on these subjects that there are few people around that can speak so authoritatively on these subjects. So I invite him back because he just does a great job. Mohammed, are you with me?
I am indeed, Daryl. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Well, you know, you've spent the time to know what the heck's going on, and you know, as I look deeper into this stuff, I'm worried. You know, that's all I can tell everybody. It's not looking good. It looks like, you know, money as we know it could end up morphing into something that we've never expected or anticipated. So we're going to get into that in a minute, but there was a recent broadcast on the 10th of December of Alex Jones brought on a guest named Humphreys. And I don't know what prompted you to look into this guy's work, but you did. And some very odd things began to show up when you did. And you contacted me about it and said, what is going on with this stuff? Now, I have for a long time told the public that that Alex Jones is not working for the truth, and that his goal is to keep people away from criminal world Zionism and criminal Judaism that's involved in these crimes that we're all experiencing. And I've been right on that. And there have been a lot of examples in him using the Loose Change video, which is just an apologist for Israeli activities, and it moves you away from it. But you found some very interesting stuff, didn't you, Muhammad? Would you share with the folks what you found?
Well, yeah, what happened was that I saw an article which claimed that Mr. Jones was by Humphreys about the current financial situation and how dangerous derivatives are. And this was a news article which was at nationalexpositor.com. And I looked at this guy's website that he was talking to. And at the beginning of the thing, I didn't listen too far into it. As you know, I never really got into Alex Jones historically because I didn't like his approach on his website. He's recently changed a little bit in that he puts some anti-Israel or anti-Zionist information out there, but originally he completely ignored the situation. And I just thought, if he's not prepared to look at the kind of tyranny which is going on with the Palestinian people, I'm not going to be interested in him. But this article on the National Expositor, it linked to this guy Humphreys, who, when you start listening to the, I think it's a Google presentation, he introduces Mr. Humphreys as a very, very good friend. And then I went to look at his website, which is on the nationalexpositor.com page. It's got a link going out there. And it goes to a website called loveorhate.com. Mm-hmm. And this is Humphrey's own website, basically. And I was trying to get to, you know, what this guy's basis was for talking about this money situation. Was he authorized, qualified? What's his experience, etc.? Well, of course, I didn't find any of that on his website. He's trying to push himself forward as believing in God and believing in the Bible. But when you actually look, a large number of books which are hosted on his webpage for sale now, they've got a lot of links and their own sort of views of theology. I spotted a couple of terms which immediately raised my hackles. One was the reference to the Tree of Life, and the other was the Law of One, both of which, if anybody's familiar with it, are Kabbalistic terms. So I started, and he himself, this Humphreys chap, says to everybody, we should follow the Law of One. Anyway, a couple of links down from the authors of these books, and you suddenly start finding that, you know, they're believing in the sun god Ra, and that Ra left these things 4,000 years ago for mankind to find out about Egyptian civilizations. Eventually, the thread makes its way to the Tree of Life, which, for anybody who's ever studied that subject, Daryl, is at the core of the Kabbalah. And they then openly start talking about the ten Sephiroth and the Kabbalah, and the magical personality and such like. All of this is derived from all the links on this guy's website. So he's pushing the Kabbalah. And as we all know, the Kabbalah is the theology, for want of a better phrase, the theology of the Oriental Rite Freemasons. It's the is the theology of our great friends, the Zohites.
That's right. And we talked a little bit about Carasso and his connection to the Italian Lodge, and the Lodge in Italy being formed out of the Paris Orient Lodge of Freemasonry, and how that was spawned the Salonika Lodge, which ultimately imploded the Ottoman Empire. So there was a direct chain of evidence. I mean, we have evidence that's cold. I mean, stone cold clear on these people's connection to all of these things. And what you're saying to me right now is that the basis for their moving up to their levels is this Tree of Life and this 10 cephaloth concept and the Ra. And now Ra, is that have something to do with that all-seeing eye?
Exactly. He was the ancient Egyptian sun god, a manifestation of the all-seeing eye, the eye in the triangle on the U.S. dollar, which, you know, again, total Freemasonic symbolism. So here we have a blatant admission by Alex Jones that this man is his very good friend. And obviously, when you look at the stuff on the website, you know, love is this and hate is that. He's got nonsense like, you know, love brings about a just economic system and hate brings about fractional reserve banking. Actually, bankers bring about or brought about fractional reserve banking, and specifically Zionist ones. Again, Zionism, Israeli connection, all of that stuff is just all totally missing from this guy's website. And he's, through this presentation of almost a biblical Christian front, is trying to drag people into hidden mysteries and secrets that ultimately brings them back to the Zoharite Kabbalah. Jones promotes himself as a Christian, and unequivocally, this man with his idea of the law of God and the law of one and belief in God and all this kind of stuff would mislead people at the first level. But when you dig down a couple of levels behind the books and the people involved in the books on that website, they're all Kabbalists and people who practice weird forms of hypnosis and hypnotic suggestions and the full everything that you could imagine there. And again, no qualification to discuss the money issue as well, Daryl, by the way.
Well, and here's the interesting thing, too. There are other sites out there, one of them called Sign of the Times, that people use as a reference that also has a great deal of Kabbalistic thinking going on it. And it pains me to think that so many people could be duped. Now, the people that generally listen to us on a regular basis don't even bother listening to Alex Jones. I've had even people say, who is he? The simple fact is, though, that he does carry a lot of people with him, and they believe he's working for to expose these criminals. But I have yet to hear him name a single name, not a Wormser, not a Ladine, not a Lauder, not a Zolkheim, not one single name of the people who have put us in this horrible state of affairs. And that alone should convince the people who are listening that are new possibly to the French Connection or hear this for the first time that this guy is a deceiver. And we have been screaming this at the top of our lungs for a long time. And I'm wondering, is there a connection in this to the Laurian Kabbalah, which is the more aggressive form of Kabbalistic thinking?
Absolutely, 100%, because what these people are promoting, the reason why I said the Zoharites, specifically the Laurian Kabbalah, as they were known in their day as the Zoharites, these guys who burnt the Talmud and the Torah when they turned their back on them and said that we only need one book from here on in, and it is the Zohar. What they said was that the Jews are the manifestation of God. They said there is a God, but it's us. We are the God, and we are our own Messiah. And one of the things that you learn about in the Law of One is that all of mankind is one, and we are God, you know, which is it's exactly the same stuff, a massive departure from traditional Judaic principles where there is an external God, not a pantheistic view, but an external monotheistic view. And these people are promoting pantheism. And they're doing it in the name of the Bible, and they're doing it in the name of probably even Jesus to some degree, because obviously Mr. Jones presents himself as a Christian, as Jacob Frank. So, you know, I'm not in the slightest bit surprised to find that his great friend is actually a guy who's pushing the Kabbalah really hard and selling loads of books on how to become a Kabbalist without actually calling that. That's another one of the deceptions, which was first brought out through the Illuminati, because when the Illuminati practices came in and the Orient Lodge practices came in, people weren't being told, you are now a Kabbalist. They were being told, you're a Freemason and you've got 33 rites, or you're a member of the Illuminati and you've got to do the various bits and pieces like this. There is no difference, absolutely no difference, between the theology, for want of a better word, of the Illuminati and the theology of this man Humphreys, who is his best friend. And he makes a big thing about trying to expose the Illuminati, doesn't he, Darrell?
And that's what he says principally is the enemy, which we both know that once you look behind the founders of the Illuminati's movement, it was all Kabbalistic Jews out of Eastern Europe. So, I mean, and we got the names. I mean, we've got the Jacob Franks of the world, and we've got their seeded people that came out of that. We have the New Bohemian movement, where many people were shipped to the United States in waves to set up much of this infrastructure as they arrived. So the fact is we've got this sussed out, but what we've all been fighting against here is the deception that they use. Now, we've got a guy here in France. You probably never heard of him. His name is Francois Bayrou. He ran for president along with Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal, and he claims to be a Catholic. And I have to tell you, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that this guy is a crypto-Catholic, a crypto-Jew, masquerading as a Catholic, and was put into the election as a spoiler to make sure that the left never got any traction, much the same as has happened in the American election process so often, and much the same as I believe Ron Paul's role is going to be by the time the election cycle ends. There are no surprises. I mean, they don't go far from the game plan when they do this stuff, do they, Mohammed?
Well, no, they've got very old techniques and methodologies. They haven't rewritten the manual on their practices. And therefore, you know, when you know what you're looking for, which I do because I've been looking at this for a very long time, as you pointed out, it's very easy for me to spot the references, spot the key terms, delve below it, and then before we know it, we suddenly realize that that the people trying to expose the Illuminati are the Illuminati, or people of the same theological worldview, i.e. Kabbalistic worldview, which is supported through pantheism, the belief that humanity is God manifest.
Well, and then the other thing is that the name Jones, actually the founder of the U.S. branch of the American the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, was actually formed by a man named Jones. So the name Jones is often a crypto-Jews cover in many instances. Of course, we know the name Jones comes from the Welsh nation from Wales, but it has been co-opted in many instances, has it not?
Many former Soviet bloc and East European Jews, when they migrated to Britain at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, when they arrived here, because they were Caucasian in appearance, all they did was adopt local-sounding names so as to fit in. But they did kind of, you know, because they didn't understand the language when they arrived here, they would often ask people, what name should we use? And names were chosen for them in literally while they were standing in the queue or maybe on the boat, and they were taught to pronounce it, and they gave that name, you know. So there are many Jews in this country called Alan or Harris, which are traditional English names to do with traditional English crafts, and they adopted those names on arrival.
Well, so we've sussed this one out, and I hope everybody out there is able to look for this information on their own, make their own determination, and then share with others if you decide that it's important information, because we here at the French Connection could use the support, the numbers, the warm bodies. We don't want blind obedience at the French Connection. We want people that we can teach these facts to. And the facts that we're going to go into right now, Mohammed, are very important because this subprime thing that we had discussed has turned into quite a larger problem than even I had thought, because it's turning out that we could even be facing the elimination of money as we know it, because if this thing fully devalues, if these monies fully implode, we're going to be stuck without a medium of exchange. Now, I mean, the idea of that is even, I mean, just to even say that, it's bizarre. But if confidence, you know, it's interesting when you talk about money. Without confidence, money has no value. And that's one of the things. People think that something in that piece of paper is intrinsically valuable. It's no more than a piece of paper of any type. And the only reason that it has value is that there's confidence in it. Once confidence has been completely eroded in that piece of paper, that value, the money no longer exists. Am I correct in saying that?
More or less, Darrell. I mean, the thing to remember, another term for money, which is a very important one as a reference point in what you're discussing, is the phrase legal tender.
Mm-hmm.
What can legally be offered up in exchange for goods? And that's always supported through the enforcement of law. So we have confidence on one side in terms of its intrinsic value, and then we've got the support of law and jail. One of the things that sometimes when I look at the state of the economy here in the UK, for instance, Darrell, I think that there's not enough money in supply, cash, M-naught, so I go out and buy myself a small printing press and print some money for the sake of the economy, which is then mistaken by the powers that be as some sort of fraudulent action when I had nothing but the best of intentions, and then you get 35 years in jail for counterfeiting.
Right.
So they back it up with the long arm of the law, and that tends to be in most places in the world.
Now, in a closed economy, let's say, for example, if they shut the borders of America down, much as they did in the Russian-Soviet transformation, and then the internal use of the dollar or the internal use of some new Amero-type currency is mandated, they can force sellers and buyers to use that medium of exchange under penalty or under color of law, can they not?
That's correct. That's exactly how they would do it.
So it would still hold its value within the economy that it is being forced upon, but outside of that, in international sense, the dollar as a source of stored value internationally would no longer hold the position of reserve currency.
Exactly. We live in a situation now where the rule of law traditionally was sufficient as a stick to beat people with in respect of forcing them to accept the value of a medium of exchange, the legal tender. Of course, that's not the case because of exactly what you said, Darrell. Now we have internationalization. We can go and sit in our front room and see the value of currently, we can go to Bloomberg's website or Reuters or one of these broker sites and look at all the currencies of the world. When you think back, you know, even 20 years ago, to actually look at that as a display was you were stood in an exchange somewhere. That was a highly privileged position to be in. Now there's enormous transparency on this, and everybody looking at it and saying, and the whole world is saying, we're not listening to the City of London say the dollar's no good at the moment. We're listening to the whole world. Anybody who studies money and money markets to some degree understands the dollar falling against the basket of currencies in the world and understands that that's bad for the dollar. That was once upon a time very privileged information, and in the terms of humanity, probably 20 years ago, was very privileged.
Well, let's take for example right now what's been happening to the euro, because the euro is the heir apparent to the, and it seems as though they're trying to keep pace with the devaluation of the dollar, so that there's some so that sleight of hand really doesn't show you these large disparities, because we know that the European banks are also having to pony up to that midnight bank loan at the cash window of some of these central banks, because their banking structure is coming under threat. And what we've seen is huge infusions of cash into the euro. And so you're getting a parallel devaluation of the euro as we speak. And I've talked to the listeners about watching prices go up 30 and 40%. I gave you an example yesterday, I think. My wife buys a lot of flour. We bake she bakes a lot of stuff, and about 6 weeks ago she bought several kilos of flour, and the price was 34 cents for a kilo, and the last, then she went back, and there's a new pallet full of flour that came in 3 days ago, and it was well over 54 cents, 53 cents or 54 cents. It had gone up by a factor of half or more than 50% rise in price between the last delivery. Now, that is astonishing, that kind of rise. I mean, 50% rise in the price of flour? That's just one thing. Diesel fuel used to be 1 euro for a liter, which is a whole lot of money by American standards, but now it's up to €1.32 and 32 cents per liter. These kinds of jumps have happened in such a short period of time that everyone is screaming about their purchasing power going down the tubes. What is happening, Mohammed? Tell us what they're really doing behind the scenes with this euro and dollar.
Well, the euro, the central banks of the world have been convinced. There's a very strange thing which has just happened now. Over the past couple of weeks, the central banks of the world were convinced by the powers that be at the Fed that supporting the Fed's actions was in the interests of the global financial system. Not economies, but the financial system, the banking system, and the financial infrastructure. So we had this process, as we mentioned before, of the central banks of the world all squeezing off half a point in their local economies, quarter of a point rather, in their local economies, so that the US could not only do its quarter point, but could even go beyond that without there being gasps of amazement and undue concern and reading into it that something terrible was going on.
And what was the general expectation, Mohammed? The professionals were expecting a certain shift, a certain amount, and I had thought that probably that if Wall Street got their way, they would want 75 basis points, but I figured 50 would be as far as they went because anything higher than 50 would panic another part of the market. So I thought 50 for sure because things are going so badly south on them that surely they were going to do that. And so what did happen?
Well, we have the central banks of the world kowtowing and agreeing to this and lowering, irrespective of the effect it has on their local domestic economies, lowering their own respective base rates. And then we've got the Fed actually turning up and making its announcement. And obviously the point here of them lowering the rates was to try and keep the dollar-euro balance, which comes back to what you were raising earlier. They were trying to maintain that because had they dropped half a point or three-quarters of a point immediately, the dollar would have dropped like a sack of potatoes at the side of the euro and the basket for that matter. So the idea was get everybody to lower it down, and then everybody stood back. Like you're saying, the logical conclusion is they're not going to match what everybody else has done. Why would they not do a quarter point? Here's why. Because, and it's very simple, Darrell, it's a zero-sum game. All the central banks in the world, including the Fed, dropped by a quarter of a point. Nothing has changed.
That's right. Status quo.
In reality, nothing has changed. The dynamics in international economies haven't changed one iota. Nothing has moved. So, therefore, everybody is waiting. The whole world is waiting for the Fed to announce this half-point drop. It's been given the tacit approval of all the central banks in the world who've lowered their interest rates, and then they only do a quarter. They announced a quarter percent. And, of course, the markets the day before, the professionals in the financial markets in America were saying to, through their various channels and in the press, we need half a point. We need half a point. We really will be beyond disappointed if we don't get half a point. There were dozens of financial institutions saying that. There were dozens. And then he didn't give it. And it's the strangest thing in the world, you know, to look on and say, well, why ask the central banks of the world to do that? And they agree. And then all the people in your domestic economy, your so-called financial experts, and you're supposed to have your ear to Wall Street and understand what they want, and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and Board of Trade Exchanges, they're supposed to have their finger on all these pulses. And these guys are saying it in the local press and in the world press and on the internet, so everybody knows what they want, and they don't deliver. Bernanke didn't deliver. It's the strangest thing.
Well, I'm going to tell you, we both talked about the possibility of why he didn't. And, of course, one of the things that we came up with was that the gold lie, and gold, ladies and gentlemen, has been so manipulated. It is the most manipulated thing on the planet, more than even financial instruments, because they're what they've done with exchange-traded funds. There are more exchange-traded funds floating around the world than there is gold to back it up by a long shot. And so what we've got is fraudulent gold paper out there in huge sums. We've got lease agreements on the actual delivery of gold that has been made, and then we're accounting for a huge sum of gold that doesn't exist in our vaults. And anybody who's looked into this knows that Fort Knox is no longer sitting on top of a fortune in gold. It's been squirreled out of there, leased out to the world, and never returned. And also, we have to take a look at the fact that if gold were to go skyrocketing, it would blow their game. Everybody would be able to see the true amount of inflation in the world and problems in the world. So they've got to keep this gold pressured down, or at least growing slowly, which is what they've been doing. They've been managing its ascent. And I think that they'd use that as one of their measures, but there's a second one, Mohammed. Maybe you could talk about this too. The renminbi is still pegged. It's not a floated currency. They won't release it on the open market for trade. And they peg it to the dollar so that they can continue to export to the United States, which allows them to end up having a net positive balance of payments. And the result of that is that they've got a huge reserve of actual cash, which you discussed with me earlier, cash that the West needs to fill some of the holes in their system, $1.3 trillion right now, to fill some of the holes in their financial mess. This problem that they only want a quarter point might have come from the Chinese as well, saying you're not doing 50 on our reserve, because a 50% drop in your rate is going to decimate our $1.4 trillion, and we won't accept that. We only want you to go 25. So I think there are probably some pressures out there that stop them from doing the 50. What do you think?
There's certainly something appears to have stepped in, doesn't it, Dal? Because we've had the central banks of the world told make the following move. We've got the professionals in Wall Street who are supposed to be the ultimate pressure on the Fed. Has got to be the guys on Wall Street, you know, that pulse, that voice, it is got to be the single biggest influence over them ordinarily. So what we have is everything is signaling. 99% of the indicators in the world are saying, 99.9 even, you know, this is going to happen. And it doesn't. So we then say, yes, what do we look at? And as you rightly pointed out, we were discussing some of these things earlier, trying to get a grip on it. And one thing that would have happened, of course, Daryl, as you pointed out to me earlier on, is that in allowing this adjustment to occur at half a point and everything feeding into the retail economy, and I'll come back to why that's important in a second, but everything feeding into that retail economy and all the growth and positive and warm feelings that would come out of that, they would have lost the ability to manipulate gold. They would have had to take, at the moment, ladies and gentlemen, they've got their foot firmly planted on the hose pipe of the gold price.
Yep.
And as you say, Daryl, they're letting it out drips and drabs and letting it go as they wish. Part of the whole bull thing would have been that had a bull Christmas occurred, gold would have just set off towards the high heavens.
Well, I think 1,500 was the stopping point by some recent analysis, and we're sitting at 813 right now. And I would have seen, and there is no resistance above 813. I mean 850. Once you hit 850, there's no resistance. It had blown through the old high of the 1980s and just started charging for 1,500 because everybody would have looked for exits. Now, Mohammed, you've got to admit, The only economic force out there other than gold that could have stopped this 50 basis point move would have been the Chinese not wanting to have their holdings debased. And, of course, there's a lot of squawking going on right now that they won't let their renminbi float. But the powers that be are not let. They don't really want that to happen either, because the whole idea here is the whole world's going to crumble at some point. I mean, the Chinese can't continue to produce junk if nobody's out there to buy it.
Now, in terms of what should have happened and why everybody was trying to get this teed up for half a point, just to come onto this for the sake of the people who haven't quite grasped what the significance of it is, it's as follows. The guys on Wall Street, the professionals, wanted half a point because they are worried about retail sales.
Yep.
This is the month now. We've got the big Christmas spend. We don't want people frightened of borrowing to go out and spend this Christmas. We need spend in the U.S. economy. They need people to buy things like they're going out of fashion, because from that we will get a huge amount of consumer confidence, because confidence, as you pointed out down at the beginning of the show, is what is missing from here now. So they've got to get the confidence back. The way to do that is to reach early January and tell everybody it's the greatest December spend on record. And that in turn is great news, because all the shelves are empty. The retailers go out and buy from the distributors, who in turn have bought from the manufacturers, who in turn buy from industry. So in terms of the supply for the raw materials for the manufacturer. So actually retail, although that represents one industry within the S&P 500, it, reliant on that are the manufacturing sectors who supply them and the distributors, and reliant upon them in turn are our friends, the actual heavy industries, which produce raw materials, the copper, the plastics, the polymers, whatever, that get used in goods manufacture. So the professionals know, Darryl, that there's going to be no bull Christmas, which means that it's going to be misery spend front. Nobody's going to be happy with retail. Retail have got stuff left on the shelves that they're not buying from manufacturers and distributors, who in turn will not be ordering from industrial suppliers. So three different concentrations, three different business industries are all smashed. And the U.S. does not need that at the time that its financial industry is in chaos.
Now, you also have to know that two of the largest companies in America are insolvent. Ford Motor Company is insolvent. It is a bankrupt company being kept afloat because it's just too big to fail. Same thing with General Motors. Both of them are failed companies. We could also say the same about companies like CompuServe, down the tubes. But there is a whole rash of bankruptcies on the offing, not far off into the future here. Within 6 months, you're going to start seeing bankruptcies of companies you thought were as good as gold, as good as solid as the dollar, as they used to say. Well, the fact of the matter is, sound as the dollar is no longer a term that has any validity whatsoever. One of the things that I'd like to bring us back to, Mohammed, because what you just pointed out was very important, but what we've got here is this banking crisis continued to mount, and we've even seen it float over into the country that has the best reputation in the world for prudent banking. And these folks have already exhausted their home reserves and their home access to cash, and actually went out and from another government borrowed money. The company I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is UBS and UBS Warburg. And you'll notice the name Warburg. That is the family Warburg, who was part of the Fed's ownership, but also one of the largest trust corporations on the planet. It's privately held. You don't even know how much they've got. Fact of the matter is they've had to go hat in hand to some governments to get bailed out, didn't they?
Well, of course, UBS is massive. It's one of the biggest banking concerns in the world, Darryl. They have somewhere in the region, the last count that I remember, something like 89,000 employees worldwide. They are a huge concern. And the intriguing thing is, as you say, Switzerland is famous for its banking secrecy and its banking prudence and being a bit more clever with banking than everybody else. And we have a situation where UBS announced that this week it has borrowed $17.2 billion from two sources. Those sources are the Indonesian government and a very wealthy Arab in the Middle East.
Was it Indonesia or was it Singapore?
Sorry, Singapore. I apologize, Daniel. Yes, you're Singapore. The point is that only a week ago, if we went to speak with the credit risk department of UBS, they will be telling us how the government of Singapore is double B rated sovereign, it's below investment grade, and we'd only be prepared to expose ourselves to a certain amount of that central bank's government issue, its bonds and its treasury notes, its treasury bills. We wouldn't be happy buying those. And here they are, borrowing something in the magnitude of $10 billion from them, and $7 billion from a private individual in the Middle East. This is to shore up a second element of their portfolio meltdown of $10 billion internally, which is added onto the $12 billion of subprime which they declared earlier this year. So UBS has lost $22 billion of cash so far this year.
Now, wait. Let's get even a little bit more speculative here on some of this. They would have never gone to Singapore as a first choice. They would have had lines of credit in their local banking market or their local governmental market that they would have been using to plug up short-term holes all along.
Absolutely.
It must be, in my view, much the same as was it Abby that had to go, or no? Who went over to the Fed to get money?
Barclays
had to go hat in hand to a foreign government to plug their holes. My point being is that they've probably already exhausted what they can get in their local Swiss banking environment. So there's probably losses much higher that you're not even seeing the other half of them.
There's no doubt about that, Darrell. In banking law, they firstly have to go to the Central Bank of Switzerland and apologize for being insolvent, and then have to say, you know, by the way, because our capital, we're unable to service the capital requirement, can you sub us $20 billion for 3 months or whatever? And then even that wasn't sufficient to get them out of the hole. They've hit the window, their limit at their central bank, and they then have to seek permission of the central bank to go outside of the country, actually. So they have been given approval explicitly, not implicitly, explicit approval by the Central Bank of Switzerland to approach a foreign government and to approach a private individual. Because, as you say, Daryl, why couldn't they borrow from Barclays? Why couldn't they borrow from Citigroup? Why aren't they turning to the markets? Because the markets are not prepared to lend to other banks. They know
that. And if you know, Citigroup is technically insolvent. The news came out today that Bank of America just had to pony up for a huge infusion. That made the wire. We've got Wells Fargo ready to pony up to announce soon that they're having to go to the cash window. We've got Abbey National belly up. We've got Barclays down the tubes. We've got Credit Agricole over here rumbling about needing money. We've got UBS Warburg going down the drain. We've got Rabobank. Was it Rabo that left the N.M. Rothschild's fold, or was that?
It's ABN AMRO.
ABN AMRO, and that's the third largest bank in Europe.
Yeah. And they actually had a partnership deal with Rothschild, N.M. Rothschild Bank in London, and ABN AMRO is divorcing itself from N.M. Rothschild and is, in fact, now looking at partnering up with the Royal Bank of Scotland, who will probably end up purchasing them.
But who called for the divorce? Might have been Rothschild kicking them out, and the Rothschilds don't care. They're gonna let Ambro say that they left. It's kind of like a man and a woman leaving and saying, "Yeah, I left him. He was bad," but really it was the other way around. But that, you know, how do we know why that thing's separating? Maybe Rothschild doesn't want to sink with their ship. when they have to start announcing their $27 billion in debt or whatever?
No, one of the most prudent banks in the United Kingdom is the Royal Bank of Scotland, and I know that for a fact because I know the people managing it. And they've got capital ratios at over 20%, and they refused to get involved in the OTC thing. They just stuck to the, as the saying goes, Darryl, sticking to the knitting. That was the view of their board, and they didn't get, they took some small exposure to it, but they didn't get into it big time. They just stuck to traditional banking, which is what they considered their strength to be. And ABN AMRO knows that NM Rothschild have got massive exposure and can't afford to go ahead with the merger business, the joint venture. They haven't got the money to put in, and that's why ABN AMRO is actually divorcing themselves from them and looking at going to Royal Bank of Scotland, because Royal Bank of Scotland has got the money to put in. It would appear that Mr. Rothschild and co. are also getting their fingers burnt at the present time.
Well, it's industry-wide, it's worldwide. And like you said before, we've discussed this, the people making the money are going to be holding hard assets when this happens, because it is, as much inflation as they're pumping into the system right now, the only thing that's going to is going to charge up when you do this kind of inflating is hard assets. And everybody who's – now, the Rothschild on one hand owns the Veolia. They own the water system. They own Alstom. They bought that thing when Alstom was at 6 or 7 cents. Now it's at 30 euros.